Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahulastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, welcome to another book club. This week we are joined by Dean Burnett, who's written a fabulous book. Oh, he's written many fabulous books, but the book we're going to talk about mainly is called Emotional Ignorance, Lost and Found in the Science of Emotion. Hello, Dr. Burnett.
I'm going to call you out of Richard Herring.
can I call you Dean? Can I call you
Please
Dr.
Do.
Dean?
Yes.
Can I call you Dr.
Yes,
Dean?
You can call me any variation you like. I don't insist on the doctor, even though I spent 5 years getting the title. I got to go, nah, don't like that. It sounds weird. And just completely sodded off.
Good. Well, for people who may not be aware of your work and who you are, do you want to give us a brief summation of who you are?
Yes, I'm Dr. Dean Burnett. I'm on paper a doctor of neuroscience. Just got my degree in Cardiff University and my postgraduate because, you know, Welsh don't go far. And spent quite a long time after that lecturing on a postgraduate psychiatry program as my job to teach all about mental health and the science thereof. But whilst I was doing my PhD, I also got a bit involved in the stand-up comedy scene and sort of write material, and I found that quite enjoyable, and then started blogging, trying to do funny things about science because people kept telling me you can't do that. So I thought, well, yeah, I can. Watch me. And then sort of like got a bit of a niche following, did some stuff for The Guardian, became part of their blog network, became the most popular part of their blog network, got approached by an agent saying, you ever thought of writing a book? Which I had, in the context of, you know, I thought about owning a jetpack one day. That'd be nice. Not going to happen. Let's never speak of it again. And so I ended up writing a book, went orders of magnitude better than anyone expected. And now that's my full-time job, full-time author now. So I'm also a bit of a go-to pundit for anything in the news people want to explain about mental health or brains. So yeah. I get around in a very strange sort of way.
That's good. So tell us a little bit about your previous books. You've done two or three more?
The current one is my fifth one. So,
fifth one, right.
First book is The Idiot Brain, which, like they said, you want to write a book. And I thought, well, like, I don't know if I can. The main ethos behind that one was that I'd read a lot of brain books for reviewing for magazines or just out of interest, and there's always a certain sort of reverence around the human brain. It's in like, oh, the brain is marvelous, fantastic, it's beyond our understanding. Don't look directly at it, you'll go blind, it's so brilliant, and that sort of attitude. But as a neuroscientist, I never sort of, I didn't have that. I had it at first, but as soon as you start studying the brain, you start realizing how incredibly messy and disorganized and counterintuitive it is. And I thought that was, I thought you weren't allowed to say stuff like that. But my publisher said, there's no rule about that. So I did. I wrote a book about all the stuff the brain does, which is wrong or bad or unhelpful or just weird. And that seemed to be something people wanted to hear about, hence the first book. Like 32 countries. I literally today, just now, I just got my the Taiwanese version through. I didn't know that was coming, but there it turned up again.
Brilliant.
Yeah, but that book, I wanted to sort of, I assumed my literary career would be a case of, okay, so these people, I got this blog people seem to like, they've asked me to do a book, I'll write the book, eventually enough people who read my blog might buy a copy, it'll break even, and we'll never speak of it again. That was how I assumed my writing career would go, but no, it went off the map in terms of success. And then they said, what's the second book? And I was like, but pardon, second book? no one mentioned a second book. But that was and it'd been a happy brain. And then I got approached to do a couple other books. One is a kid's book, my third book, Why Your Parents Are Driving You Up the Wall and What to Do About It, sort of like explaining the parent-teen conflict from the teen's perspective.
Sure.
And there was psychological, about the science of mental health, all stuff I learned in like the postgraduate psychiatry teaching and things like that. And now I've got Emotional Ignorance, about emotional experiences and why they happen, et cetera, et cetera. So, odd career.
Well, this book, I mean, it's sort of quite an interesting genesis. It wasn't the book, I mean, and you know, interesting and unfortunately tragic genesis in that it wasn't the book you were intending to write. Can you tell us a little bit about how this book came about?
Yeah. Well, the origin story, the original spark is really quite... quite sort of almost embarrassing in terms of, like, if you read a lot of mainstream science books, they usually start with something profound, or like someone has an epiphany which leads to this incredible journey, and it's usually somewhere quite exotic. The opening chapter is always like the author saying, as I was stood there in the middle of the Amazon rainforest watching the juvenile capybaras frolic in the lush undergrowth, and I became at one with life and nature and our place in the universe, I ended up wondering, bollards, what's that about? You know, is it something something like that? But I was actually sat in my student house watching Fear Factor, the American show, watching someone eat like several inches of raw horse intestine. And that was, it took me as odd, because that's disgust. That's not fear. It's a different thing. I remember thinking, people would normally pick up on that. They would be annoyed that this is completely violating the format, but no one seemed to register it. And that was the first spark of me thinking, I don't think people understand emotions as well as we think we do.
Yeah.
Come to many years later on, I did a book with Happy Brain, all about what makes us happy. And one of the questions I kept getting was, you wrote this book about happiness, why not any other emotion? Which is, I know they were just curious, but it's quite a backhanded insult, really. It's like, you wrote this book, why don't you write a different book? Cheers. Glad you enjoyed it. But yeah, there was a lot of questions about emotions. So there clearly is an interest out there for the science of emotions, how they work. So I pitched that as my next book. So I'll just write about all of them. And I assumed it would be like The Idiot Brain, like a more fun, lighthearted, you know, go through all the different emotions, your fear, anger, sadness and stuff, and explain some funny examples of how they work. And yeah, we shook hands, agreed on that. And I sat down to write it. And it was, I had assumed, based on what I've been led to believe previously, that the science of emotions is well established and very, very well known. We'd moved on from there because it was one of the first things neuroscience dealt with. And then we're doing tricky stuff like memory and perception and thinking and stuff. But no, science of emotion is incredibly complex, incredibly poorly understood and hotly debated. So my whole idea for a book about the basics of emotions explained in an easy way was not going to happen. Unless I wanted to lie, which I really shouldn't do that. So so the whole plan got derailed from that point.
Yeah. And then the book sort of changed. I mean, it's still entertaining and there's still a lot of funny stuff in there, but it due to personal circumstances, you had a kind of a very sort of tragic end to this as well, and that your father died during the COVID.
Yes, pandemic. He fell ill with COVID at the very start of the pandemic, and totally out of the blue. He's only 58. We didn't have any prior health issues, apart from having a gallbladder removed once. But that's one of those just things that happens occasionally. So no one saw it coming. I was actually I was looking forward to the pandemic, but I felt I was well suited to ride it out nicely because I've been working from home since 2018, like a living hipster or something. And people weren't going to stop buying books. If anything, the odds are it was going to go up, and people want to know about the mental health consequences of lockdown. So I was primed to be like, oh, I'm going to, this is going to serve me as well as anyone. But then sort of lost my father in the first month of the pandemic, and I had to experience that in the hardest, most strict part of lockdown. Like no one coming to help, no one being able to comfort you, no one taking the pressure off your shoulders, with two small kids at home, like obviously depended on me because they had no one else at the moment, apart from my wife, obviously. And no options to grieve, to process it as people would normally do, even a much more restricted funeral, can't hang with your friends. You couldn't even go drown my sorrows in the pub, which is not a healthy response, but it's an option. So couldn't even do that, So all I had was a head full of emotions, powerful emotions, and a contract to write a book about emotions. So it was quite so logically I should do something with this overlap of of factors. And that's what the book ended up being. It ended up being essentially my grief journal, but my self, exploring all these things going on in my head right now. Why are these happening? What's the benefit of this in the evolutionary sense? Why is my brain reacting in this way to this loss? Is it a point to this? What's the underlying purpose? And found out lots of different things which were quite telling, I think. And
it is interesting to see, it's obviously tragic, and it's it would be a lot better if it hadn't happened, but it did give you a very interesting perspective. I think certainly in that sort of the initial point of it is that you sort of feel you're not reacting emotionally as you would expect yourself to do. You're not crying at the funeral or there's various things. So that's immediately from the book's point of view, it's sort of going, oh, so emotions that don't work in this kind of prescribed way. So it's a very engaging and upsetting, but interesting start point to the book.
Yeah. Well, it was written almost like in real time, really. Because I started writing it, the early parts when my father was just really ill. He hadn't passed yet, but I was like in that very tense, frustrated, impotent state of, I am worried, I am panicked, but I'm also completely, utterly helpless to do anything about it. And that causes a whole unique emotional experience. So I thought, well, I'll channel that. I'll write about this in case it comes in handy. And it goes sort of, chapter by chapter goes, if first it's him being really unwell, then it looks like he is going to pass and he does die, and then dealing with that and then revisiting that later. So I try to make it as authentic as possible, because I was like, I'm in this emotional state right now. Theoretically, I know in a year's time I'll be in a different headspace. So I think it's important to get this on, in writing now while it's happening, so I can at least then I can look back and say, that's what I was feeling and that's why. And so I think that was but emotions really sort of complicated. And I think it was one of the main things of the book, in that we expect these things to happen in this way, and they rarely ever do. It's just like the cultural assumption, which I learned is often, if not wildly oversimplified, just basically wrong.
Yeah. And it's interesting from a writing point of view. And I suppose I've been through something, broadly speaking, similar, though I can't claim it's the same. In lockdown, I had testicular cancer, and I and I had to go through all of that. And, I had to worry about my own, whether I was going to survive or not. And so I had all those emotions and reacted emotionally in different ways as well. But equally, I found, that year I just really threw myself into getting fit and writing about it and getting everything down. And it was very therapeutic to do that. And in fact, by the time I came to write the book, it actually probably kind of, I was actually at a point where I'm actually have some understanding of what's happened to me. And it's a bit harder to write the book than it might have been if I'd done it at the time. But it's because it's a slightly different thing. But it was, it did strike me that you threw yourself into your work as your only real option. But that was clear in this whole book. I think it's very helpful for anyone who's been through any emotional thing, because you'll learn all about your emotions. But certainly anything like that, it will make you think about why you reacted and how you reacted and how everyone reacts differently to things. But what I'm getting at is the therapy that comes from writing, which doesn't have to be someone writing a book that's going to be published, but that was helpful.
Totally, yeah. I mean, I think it's when you articulate things. I mean, that's one of the main things I found from the research, but also one of the points I do try and get across when everyone asks me about it, is that it's really important to understand that the parts of your brain which produce your emotions are also the same parts your brain uses to deal with them, to process them. So it's when you sort of bottle them up and shut them down or suppress them, you're essentially set up a blockage in the way it works through things. So that's why it's important to actually not shut yourself off from these negative emotions. You're just like, well, a lot of men do that, and it's extremely unhealthy. But also, like I think you mentioned just now, I didn't cry at the funeral, only later that night. And I mean, based on my own education, my experiences, my research, everything, I know that it's not unhealthy to cry at a funeral when a very sad event. It's the saddest day of my life. I'd have every right to cry. No one would have judged me. But the cultural sort of influence of saying, no, don't do that. You must be stoic. You must be man. You must be firm and strong, like your dad would have wanted. And that sort of went in a lot deeper than I'd realized. So I was it's almost like, you know, it's like when you know, you want to sneeze, but you can't. It was like that with crying. It's like, come on. I know full well this is necessary and it's going to happen, but why is it not happening now? And it was so weird to experience that, even though I theoretically know it's wrong, but subconsciously I seem to have really deeply integrated that message. And so trying to get that out there it's an important aspect of getting this book promoted as best I can.
Yeah, of course. And I think it just, I hadn't really thought about this subject, which, you know, as you say, it's not been properly studied really. And there's no like consensus on why emotions are there and what they're for. Yeah. But it, you know, you, I think like the way you, the first time you talk about Data from Star Trek and how he's sort of this emotionless, very logical, soup, you know, being, but that actually without emotions, without any emotions, you know, people or a robot would be nothing really. It's so much, our emotions are so much a part of what makes us us, certainly what makes us human. And you don't really think about it, but if you had no, you know, if you could say, I'm going to cut off all emotion and I'm not going to show any emotion, you wouldn't actually, you talk about it, asking Data what flavor ice cream he would like, and you would have no preference because it wouldn't make any sense to him. But when you think about an emotionless being of any kind, I guess, even including animals, it would be a sort of a void really, rather than something to want.
Yeah, totally. If you there's so many people online, again, usually guys, but not always, who say like, oh, I only think with emotions, I only use reason and logic. Because you don't. You are, you know, that's impossible to do for a human brain. We just have too much, emotions too heavily embedded in everything we do. And I think you look at it sort of completely logically. Pure logic and reason quickly leads to sort of a nihilistic tendency. And like I mentioned now, scientists are supposed to be these logical, cold beings, but science as a career isn't easy. It's really hard. You know, you have to work really hard to get at it. It's not the most financially rewarding. It's really uncertain because you have to chase the grants here and there. You can spend years doing one experiment and ends up proving nothing. So the only, you know, logically, you wouldn't do that. That's a totally daft way to live your life. But scientists do it because they care. They want to do it. It means they are emotionally invested. So scientists can be the most emotional people. And sure. Yeah, this idea that you can only, you know, you must only function with reason and logic. It isn't how we work. We can't do it. It's not what we are. And evoking Data from Star Trek was an obvious example of famous character who doesn't have emotions. But yeah, I think one thing I read, which I put in the book, which I was really quite sort of, oh my God, of course, is that the reason we think logically in the first place, we put so much emphasis on logic and reason, is because when we do it, we like it. We feel good about thinking logically, you know, using logic and reason, which ergo is an emotional reaction. So
yes.
Without emotions, you wouldn't be logical. It's like one of those chicken and egg situations, but in your brain.
Yeah, and I think it's fascinating, and I think also I'd never really considered like how instinctive emotions are. So a lot of it's like almost beyond our control, but also that's obviously where the idea of emotion started, was just as an instinct, really, within whatever was the first creature that was able to feel something in that way. It's a way of each thing gives some kind of benefit, even when it's a negative emotion. There's some reason why that's developed in us. So can you tell us a little bit about how you perceive emotion started up and why it started up?
Yeah, the main sort of I think I don't. It's obviously impossible to prove because it happened quite some time ago. But I think people genuinely assumed or agreed that the first emotion to evolve would have been fear. Because of all the emotions, like, it's the one which keeps you alive. So, you think of the most primitive life forms, like, sense something. Is it dangerous? Yes. Right. Run. And then that's that keeps you alive. Therefore, your genes propagate. And I think one part of the book I do really explore, which I find really fascinating, the link between emotion, memory, and smell. Because it all comes like from the very, very dawn of life. You think of the very earliest life forms, sort of tiny blobs of cells in the primordial soup, whatever. We're talking just complex bundles of chemicals in a complex chemical environment. So the only thing you can really sense, which tells you anything, is the chemicals in the world around you. And what is that if not smell? You know, it's just detecting a change in the chemicals around you. So you can sense something, but then once you've got this primitive brain which can take in information, it's going to do something with that. It's going to be able to store it. And it's going to be able to respond to it. And therefore, you get smell being linked to memory formation and emotional reactions. So like crude emotion saying, that bad, leave bad thing, go. And then your memory says, like, remember bad thing for next time. And you can see in the modern brain now, like the current human brain, smell and emotion and memory are far more physically intertwined in the more fundamental parts of the brain than other senses, even though sight and sound are more dominant senses, and they're more bigger parts of the brain dedicated to them. The sensory information which goes into our it goes through an optic nerve into our occipital lobe, like the visual processing centers, that gets shunted through the thalamus, like the big hub of information in the middle of the brain. Whereas smell information skips all that, just goes straight into the memory and the motion centers, and gives us a much more strong memories. So that's why smells can be so evocative, so emotionally provocative, and trigger such powerful memories. It's because they have a sort of a VIP pass into the memory system, because one theory is that they were the first to evolve, and the brain and meant smell, emotion, memory evolved in lockstep. So that's why we have this deep, powerful response to familiar smells and things.
Sure.
And so that's one interesting aspect of that, I've always thought.
Yeah, no, it's really fascinating. And then the more, we obviously, it all builds up as we become more kind of complex beings.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I also found. I mean, there's so much to talk about in this book. It's a chunky book. I was saying compared to David Baddiel's book, it's you put some work in. Like Baddiel's written like an essay, and you've written this incredible detailed. Yeah. But I prefer Baddiel because it's easier to do. It's a short book.
Don't set me up as an nemesis to David Baddiel. I don't have that much clout.
But if you're between the two of you, you've written two average length books, so that's fine. There's so much in there that we can't, obviously, and I don't want to talk about it all because I want people to read the book. But thinking of my own experiences as well, I kind of, the way that other people's emotions can sort of hop between each other, like, you know, I think maybe you talk about this, or maybe this was me thinking of it, but in the way like a shoal of fish or birds all move together, that the actions of the emotions work like that. And I was at a funeral where I wasn't expecting not to cry. It was of a friend of mine, but I wasn't crying. But then there was like a palpable, and it felt like a wave going through the congregation, or whatever you call the people, the mourners at the funeral. And I could almost sense it approaching, and it hit me. And then I was absolutely like weeping sort of beyond my control, absolutely instinctively. And I kind of experienced that feeling where the empathy shoots through the room and everyone sort of feels the same thing. But I was absolutely destroyed. I was absolutely crying my eyes out. That's something you talk about, this sort of the way that we can sort of unconsciously sort of influence each other.
Yeah, that's it's emotional contagion. It's related to empathy, because empathy, like a big part of emotion, which way more than I realized before I started writing, is like just sharing it. It's not just about experiencing emotion; it's broadcasting it to our fellows. And so much of our brain is attuned to and dedicated to, and has evolved to detect these signals and experience them ourselves. It's such an incredibly complex system. And people like think mind reading is like one of those sci-fi powers, but we're pretty good at it. You know, we're actually pretty good at it on an instinctive level. Don't know we're doing it. It's just that we detect other people's emotions rather well and experience them ourselves. But when you have that, and if you don't know what the source is, normally you're talking to one person and you can see the expressions, their stance, their tone. You pick up, oh, this is a sad person. I am sad for them. But when it's like you're, like say, in a room full of people who are all feeling the same thing, and you don't know where it's coming from, but you know, it's because there's so many people doing it at once. That's emotional contagion. It just like leaks over onto you. You're picking up the vibe.
Yeah.
So like I mentioned the funeral example, that you can go to a funeral of someone you don't know, have no emotional connection with, because you're there to support someone else. But you will feel sad because, you know, everyone in the room is sad, and you can't avoid that. Or obviously, you know this better than anyone, but at a comedy gig, there's a lot of stats show that if you're in a crowd of people, you're like 30 times more likely to laugh.
Yeah.
At whatever, you know, if you look at the exact same thing, like you could, whether you're in a gig or watch it later on DVD, you're far more likely to laugh when you're around people, because other people are laughing too, and laughing is such a social emotion, such a, you know, expressive one. You can't help but get caught up in the room. Like I've been in gigs where like the comedian himself, he's all right. You know, I think not my particular thing, but I'm laughing because other people are just getting really caught up in it, and you get swept up in it that way. And
that's interesting, in fact, because like it is in a comedy gig when it's going well, and believe me, it's not always the 30 times with my gigs, that doesn't happen that much. But the contagion, again, you can often on stage feel like, again, a wave going through the audience. So you can feel the laugh going backwards and forwards as the contagion happens. And you get that in big rooms, and I've played somewhere like the Apollo, you really get this roll that comes forwards and back like a tide. That is obviously people influencing each other around each other, which is sort of, again, is when you stop and think about it, it's such a bizarre thing to happen.
Totally, isn't it?
Yeah.
It sort of works in music too. But one reason we like music is like attributed to emotional contagion, because you can be in a situation where you're having a good time, experiencing a positive emotion, and if there's background music, it might not even be consciously aware of it, but if it's there, then your brain will go, oh, had good feelings now. That music was there. I like that music. And even if you don't want to like it, you know, because I think in the book I sort of go in a weirdly unexpected defense of the Venga Boys, which is atypical in usual science books, but yeah, because they were, you know, they were just constantly playing, doing my more, you know, enjoyable parts of my teenage years in the summertime, yeah, when, you know, all that Europop was going on. So I have this weird fondness for the Venga Boys, even though I'm objectively aware that it's absolute pap. You know, there's nothing.
Well, again, I found this interesting because this is something that I experienced as well. But you talk that this is one of the things I wanted to write down that I forgot to write down. But now, luckily,
good.
Is that you aren't that into music, so you don't like. Some people come and remember a gig and have a massive emotional response to music.
Mm.
And I think, like you, I mean, I'd like music, and it's okay, but it's not a massive deal in my life at all. I don't really understand. I understand it, but I don't get the same emotional reaction.
I can't relate to people who say, like, this album is the most profound thing I've ever listened to. Or, like, sounds nice. That's my, like, I think I mentioned it. With music, I'm like wine. Yep, there's white, there's red, there's pink. I don't mind any of those, you know. I don't have, like, I don't sniff it around. I don't have a collection. I just, give it to me. I'll enjoy it. But, don't have this deep emotional connection most people seem to have. You know?
Yeah, so that's it. So why do, I mean, I've been, again, through lockdown, I discovered that I have aphantasia, so I can't produce, I can dream, but I don't produce mental images. Mm. And I wondered if that, you know, and it feels like a loss now I know I've got it, and it feels like, I don't want to say a disability because that's not right, but let's use that as a broad term. It's not, it's clearly not the same. But it feels, you know, it feels like now I know it's that I don't have the thing that someone else has. And I wonder, you know, when you have a part of the human experience that most people experience, and I've got music as well to add to that, maybe it's connected. Is there a reason why, you know, someone like you and I don't like music, or is there a reason why that some people don't get visual images inside their head?
Yeah, I mean, everyone's going to have, you know, the brain, everyone's individual brain is wildly different and unique. I mean, like, the example I've used in, I can't think it's in this book, but if you think that, you know, everyone has their own set of fingerprints, which is like a few patterns of some lines on a bit of skin, consider we have like 100 billion neurons to connect, and our brains are going to be even more unique. So some people will just develop in a way which means they don't have this thing, or it's not as powerful, or it's not as present in their life. Regarding the music thing, for me, whilst writing, I was trying to extrapolate why don't, because all my family love music, you know, they're all really musical, and it's like, again, that's one of the reasons I got into brains in the first place, I think, because I was a very different child compared to the rest of my family and friends. Like, I'm from the South Wales Valleys, where my father was a landlord of a pub, you know, grew up in that sort of environment, and everyone, like, sports, drinking, carousing, loudness, rah, singing. Like, my family back home are known as the Von Krapps, because they sing constantly and are, despite constant request not to, which is a very, you know, informative thing. But I never had that, so I thought, like, well, I'm weird. Why am I like this? And I got me into, you know, reading about brains and something wrong with my brain. I never found an answer, but I did get an interest. So here we are, like 35 years later.
Yeah.
And but I think, you know, explanation I did come up with was that I was like two or three, just me and my parents in a tiny terraced house in the South Wales Valley. It's very quiet, very subdued, very sort of, you know, cozy little environment. And then I remember, like, being very young on, like, my father's shoulders, going into this pub we're going to live in, this massive, big, drafty building. And suddenly my life is full of strangers and breezy and, you know, big open spaces and scary old buildings and full of people with, and music was constantly playing. So I think maybe at a young age I sort of, music means big, scary change. Don't like that. And so just tipped me in that direction a bit too far, perhaps. So I don't dislike music, but I don't have this deep passion for it that other people seem to have.
Yeah, and as you say, that's the human experience we've got. You know, like, conversely, I like going on stage and performing in front of people, which most people wouldn't want. So obviously it's, and I don't mind singing, and I don't mind, you know, I don't mind performing music. It's interesting how different we are, and how similar we are. I mean, you do some work in trying to destroy the comedy community in which I don't mind, because this is something that I've always thought anyway, that that men and women perhaps are not as different as comedy and the newspapers and the world would make you think, in terms of their brains at least and their emotions.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we are prone to different chemical influences. Obviously, women and men have different hormonal factors which shape our development and our upbringing and our internal workings and things like that. But I think it's probably quite a crude metaphor to use, but it's close enough, I think. It's good to think of men and women's brains as like being the same computer running slightly different software. So like they could do different things, but the underlying hardware is all there. I mean, the experiment I point at, which I found really quite intriguing, was the one where subjects were given testosterone and made to play this game. And then those who were given testosterone were more aggressive, more assertive, more dominant in a typical testosterone way. Except truth is they were told they were given testosterone, but they weren't. They were just given a placebo. Whereas people who were told they were just given a neutral substance were given testosterone, they became more cooperative, more friendly, more willing to help others. Because the thinking is that testosterone is actually not about dominating and anger and violence. It's all about status, making you want to be, improve and enhance your status amongst others. But on many instinctive levels, humans are cooperative and we want to help each other. That's why the secret of success, the whole alpha male thing, that's the cultural creation. And nature is in humans is cooperation and collaboration.
Yes.
But in this subject, people may think, but still, shows that men are just completely vulnerable to their hormones, but all the subjects were women in this experiment. So women given testosterone behaved more cooperatively, but women who were told they were given testosterone but weren't became more aggressive and assertive. So much of it is cultural and learned from the world around us that way more than we think, than we realize. So yeah, that was quite eye-opening, I think.
I've thought that, and also because as I think you say in this book, it's obviously even if there's men are taller than women, there are some women are taller than some men. The world is such a variety of people, and I think it was a big thing in my just in my dating life. I think by the time I got in my 30s, I kind of just. You've been told so much that women were a certain way in dating or wanted a certain thing. And then the minute you just go, they're just people and some of them will want this and some of them will want that. They want different things. I'll find one that wants the same thing as I want. And then that'll be fine. And, it completely turned my life around to realize. I think when I did Talking Cock and got luckily I kind of put out, I did anonymous questionnaires to men and women. And the female responses just made me realize, women kind of like men mostly in the most part. And women have had good experiences with men in the most part. And I think it is that cultural thing. And women want to have sex, which again, I think you would, in the 80s and 90s, we were sort of told that we had to trick women into wanting to have sex, which is part of the reason I think the world turned out to be such a terrible place. But yeah, it is very interesting. But if you write a book about how cats and dogs are the same, then you're going to be in trouble, Dean. Because
I have a cat and a dog, and I will happily clarify that I will never write that book.
that's all we comedians have left. I'm being slightly flippant, and you are a fan of Pixar films, and I don't think you mentioned this Pixar film. How close did Inside Out get to, which is a film all about emotions? Have you seen it? I presume you've seen it.
Yeah.
How close do you think it got to getting our emotions right?
I didn't mention the book actually because it was when my daughter was watching it, laughing at the bing bong scene.
That's probably why it was in my head.
Yeah, and I'm on the sofa just bawling. She was wondering why are you crying at the rainbow wagon? It's okay, yeah. A lot of emotional scientists don't like it because it does make the thing of we all have these specific single emotions, these dominant emotions, fear, anger, happiness, sadness, and that's an old-fashioned view, still quite influential, but it's becoming less and less popular as the constructivist view comes into play, where it's like the argument is that we actually create every emotion wholesale in the moment, much like we create our perception or like recreate our memories from stuff. So there's no, some people argue that you have the basic emotions like the keys in a piano, like these are the notes you can play, you can create symphonies of these, whereas some argue it's more like white noise and you can shape it. But aside from that, I do think the Inside Out did some really impressive work in terms of the science of it all. There's a bit which they keep doing, I don't think anyone's picked up on, but I noticed it whenever anger wants to do something, fear tries to stop him, and he sort of punches him in the face. And that's actually scientifically accurate, because anger overrules fear. It causes approach motivation as opposed to avoid motivation. So it actually, that's a scientifically valid bit of violence, if that makes any sense. A rare phrase to be able to use. But yeah, so they've clearly done a deep dive there, and the whole, certain tunes stay in your memory forever, and they are... yeah, so it's aside from the whole, we have these basic emotions, which is a... I totally get what in terms of the narrative, they'd have to do that. They can't just have like this big blob of amorphous emotions just talking all the time. But other than that, yes, I think it did a good job.
Oh, that's good, very good. There's loads of little bits that I love. I just like the three types of tears. I thought that was a really interesting fact. We're talking about crying earlier. We should have brought it up then. But can you tell us about the three types of tears? I'd like to hear that.
Yeah, like that's what became explored into that. Due to thinking of the physical aspect of emotions. I think people still think emotions as these totally abstract mental creations, but they have a profound physiological presence as well, which is why they were studied in the first place, like by the ancient Greeks and things. So, yeah, we have, you know, we think of crying. Like, why do we cry? What's the purpose in squirting liquid from your eyes when you're in an upset state? But there are lots of different types of tears. There's basal tears, which is the film which covers your eyes at all times, the very thin layer of liquid. There's reflex tears, which is what you cry when you got dust or onion vapor in your eyes, like you're trying to flush it out. And psychoemotive tears, which are the tears produced by emotions. But those are actually chemically different to the other two. They contain certain types of hormones and other chemicals, which suggest they have a specific function rather than just be visible. So you can think, well, you're crying, that means they're sad. That means it's more clear that they're sad. But then, you know, you cry when you're angry sometimes. You cry when you're happy, of tears of joy, as they say. So, yeah, so the idea that we have different types of tears, like the emotions can fundamentally chemically change the liquid being put up by your eyes, shows us how deeply intertwined in our physiology they are, how fundamental they are to everything we do.
And I think it is, and I think like one of the messages of the book, which I think hopefully comes through to everyone, is just you know, how we are this cooperative species, and how we are reading each other and reacting to each other, and how we are like a shoal of fish going through the world, sort of looking after each other. You know, and I think that we're this social creature, and that's the reason our emotions are so important. That's why we've got this far, because those emotions are to help each other as much as anything, as much as to, you know, we're showing people how we're feeling, we're passing on information, warnings. If someone's angry or upset, it's, you know, something's going on that you have to react to. So it is this sort of social aspect of emotions.
Yeah, absolutely. Humans are much more, you know, we are labeled as an ultra social species. I mean, there are a lot of arguments say that we are the most social species on Earth, and that's why we are as successful as we are. This whole dog eat dog, you know, alpha male type stuff is a modern creation. We haven't been like that. Our cooperation and collaboration is a huge part of how we exist and how we are. And like the evolution of that is really quite profound as well. Like the fact that the sort of argument say that the mother baby bond, where like a mother forms a deep emotional attachment with the newborn baby, that's obviously a really powerful emotional connection. But at some point in human evolution, that was like detached. It didn't have to be just that anymore. Now we can apply it to friends, partners, you know, loved ones. And that makes us far more emotionally open to the wider world and things like that. So yeah, so like it was a massive emotional achievement, and an evolutionary one as well. So to suppress it and deny it seems so counterproductive on every level that shouldn't do that, essentially.
Well, look, there's so much. I mean, we can't get through it all. You can find in this book, you can find out why people are into BDSM and why Fifty Shades of Grey is so popular, why we'd want to hurt each other. It's quite interesting. There's some good relationship advice, which I could take about about not trying to solve my wife's problems all the time and just to listen to her problems. I know I should do all the time, but I always try to come up with solutions, which makes her upset. So you're 100% correct. You know, and I think it does make you think about your own, you know, and my own journey through various emotions. But, you know, I used to get very angry when I was younger, And that hasn't happened. But now it's come back a little bit if I'm tired. And,
well, yeah, of course.
And,
yeah.
the kids are acting up, or my wife's acting up. You know, suddenly that, or to be fair, if I'm acting up, that kind of anger comes back, which is a sort of terrifying thing when you can't control, or you know, when it takes you over and you lose control for a little while. That sort of, but it's very interesting to hear about that. And I think also the final chapter, or the final part, the final section about manipulation of emotions, which again feeds right back into the whole COVID story and the conspiracy theories that people are able to come up with that. And the way that people can manipulate your emotions and get you into groups, and you want to be in a group, and then you can start believing nonsense or things.
Absolutely, yes. It's, disconcerting how it seems to be so easily done, isn't it?
Yeah, you talk about how the Facebook and everything have got their research wrong, which is interesting, and ascribing emotions that are written as being the true emotions. But equally, I think it is a warning that we can be manipulated as a species as a result of, especially things like fear and anger.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, all of them. I mean, it is this. You know, the minute you start thinking about it, it's just one of those books again that just sends you off in lots of different directions. It'll remind you of your own embarrassments that you remember because they're helpful to you, and you'll find out why your own embarrassments stay in your memory so much. But it'll make you think about your own reactions to stuff, and also there's a lot of important messages in there, but there's a sort of positivity to it as well, in terms of exactly what we're saying about how
I don't want to end up on doom and gloom. Like, I think, it was me coming at the end of my, it's never an end to it, but the grief and loss and the emotional trauma of that, and sort of figuring that out, for want of a better description.
Yeah.
Because I think so many people would be in the similar situation, given everything we went through, and just life in general seems how it works. So, yeah, I would just sort of end it in a sort of very encouraging way. These things happen, but here's why they happen. And hopefully by knowing that, you can feel a bit better about it.
Yeah. So, it's a really great subject for a book, even though it's not what you might have thought you were going to do when you started you do really cover everything, I think, in such a great way. So I would highly recommend you buy Emotional Ignorance by Dr. Dean Burnett. Is there anything you've been reading recently that you would like to recommend to our listeners that you didn't write?
Believe it or not, I'm one of those sci-fi fans. Looking at me, you must be shocked to hear that. But one thing I'm pointing a lot of people to Martha Wells' books, the Murderbot series recently. It's really quite funny, but it's sort of like a cheap security cyborg. We got mass produced. We sort of becomes independent and deals with anxiety and social anxiety. So it's a really interesting take on. It ends up being a bit of a buddy cop comedy, at times, and something like learning how to work up emotions from a completely new perspective. So, yeah, the Martha Wells Murderbot series, I will always happily point people to for that.
Okay,
sort of thing.
Fantastic. It's been lovely to meet you virtually, and despite the fact that means we can see each other, so we can pick up up cues from each other.
Cues from the chest up, yes.
You don't want to see what's going on under the table. And you've made me think maybe I should be using emojis in my online. If you can use the emoticons properly, that helps get your emotions across to people, which is of course the problem of non-visual communication online. Well, I say the problem, one of the tiny problems of a massive huge problem.
Quite a few to get through there.
There are a few to get to. Look, really, really love to talk to you, and good luck with the book, and good luck with all your books.
Thanks very much, Richard. Check them out, everyone.
Dr. Dean Burnett, thank you also to Chris Evans. Not that one. Thank you very much, Dean.
Cheers, Richard. Thank you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can. And make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.